Thank you, Lex. It is, of course, a great honor to be replacing John, but the circumstances are very unfortunate. All the more because we were all, I think, looking forward to one of John's famous, inspiring talk, and instead, all of us are now stuck with me for 20 minutes. And unfortunately, I can't even be a bad copy, or a bad replication, maybe I could say, of John. So what I felt I could do for today was bring my own perspective, the way it is evolving around these issues. And so, whereas this was John's original intended topic, I felt I would add this as my personal perspective on introducing this morning's session. What do I mean by conceptual challenges? In particular, what I want to explore is the sense in which we can and should arguably talk about replicability or reproducibility crisis in science. And in order to make my points, I'll take inspiration from a few empirical results that we obtained recently with John and with Rodrigo Costas of Leiden University around examining the prevalence of biases in meta-analysis, and in particular I'll focus on these three major issues that are said to or correctly believed to underline or indicate the possibility of a selective reporting. So small study effects, gray literature bias, and decline effects. And this will give me the opportunity essentially to discuss one of the, I think, crucial issues that we should be mindful about when talking about a reproducibility crisis, which is the question of where, meaning in what field, for example, or context, and what might the problems we want to address be. And even a deeper question is raised about what reproducibility itself means. What do we mean when we say that there is a reproducibility crisis? And whether a crisis narrative is still the best way to characterize what is inspiring all the great work that has been presented at an impressive conference such as this one. So, as Lex mentioned, selective reporting is identified as a main cause of irreproducibility. Now, a lot of the understanding around this issue comes from meta-analysis. For those of you who are not familiar with what a meta-analysis looks like, this is the most illustrative graphical representation of a meta-analysis. It's a forest plot, so-called, where different studies have their main effect concerning a specific hypothesis extracted and compared to obtain an overall summary. The summary is based on weighting the main effect reported by different studies by some measure of precision. This primarily has to do with the size of the sample used by the study, and this is often represented, as in this case, by the size of the square, indicating where the effect size is. And more completely, one normally indicates a confidence interval represented by the bar, which also includes essentially the variance within the sample itself. This is a real-life clear example of a possible small study effect, in that you can see how you have three huge studies all reporting effectively non-statistically significant results. And then you have this odd one out small study, which is highly imprecise and yet is actually reporting a rather extreme effect. An even more direct proxy, actually let me stress another thing. So the idea would be that a small study like this, being more subject to random sampling variation, offers, in a sense, more opportunities for researchers to capitalize on chance in obtaining a strong result. And at the same time would have, per se, being small, lower chances to be published unless it reported a statistically significant result. So the end result is that you have this kind of distorted picture of the literature. If there were no bias, you would expect small studies to fall all along the spectrum of possibilities. A gray literature bias is an even more direct indication of a possible selection of publications. This is again a real life example concerning mostly, I think, industry studies on nicotine replacement therapies. And you see how you have most studies all lining up reporting a positive result. There is one study that oddly found a completely different result, and I'll let you guess which one was the one that wasn't published. And so that is called the grey literature because it doesn't appear in the formal peer-reviewed literature. So what we did to get an imprint of how extensive these issues are in science was to try to draw a representative sample of meta-analysis from all disciplines. Of course, this will be all disciplines or all fields within disciplines that do meta-analysis to begin with. So it's as representative as we could make it in that sense, but we had a decently large sample. And so from each of these studies, we took back one meta-analysis from which we extracted the fundamental information concerning the primary studies, as well as relevant study characteristics, such as precision or whether it was published in a journal or not, to then estimate in each meta-analysis whether there was an association between the magnitude of reported effect size and whatever characteristic we were looking at. And then what I'm going to show you is effectively the summary of these estimates running across the entire sample. So it's a second-order meta-analysis of these results. So a weighted average of what's going on in science. And this is the key result that I wanted to show you. So this is how we estimate small study effects to run across the entire sample. And this is how we estimate gray literature effects, gray literature bias to occur. And in both cases, the predictions are matched exactly, that we have a strong positive effect in one, in this case, as should be expected. And we see that gray literature reports, on average, smaller effects. However, there is more to the story than this. There is more to the story than an average. And this is what actually these numbers and some of these details, which I'm not going to mention, indicate. The point of providing this external information is that if you look at how these effects are, for example, distributed across the meta-analysis, you see a picture that is very nuanced. For one thing, we have a long tail of extreme effects, which in the overall summary don't have usually much of an influence because these are small meta-analysis, so they weigh less in the overall summary. Whereas overall, what one gets, in any case, is a reasonably normal distribution of effects around, closely to the null value, which is shifted in the direction that we measured. So it does indicate overall, of course, that there is, on average, more often than not, if you like, the possibility of encountering this effect. But the diversity of situation is quite remarkable, certainly higher than I might have expected, for example. And the point is that there is a huge amount of heterogeneity around how these effects are distributed, and it's not random heterogeneity either. So one can start partitioning the sample, for example, by separating meta-analysis in the physical sciences, the biological sciences, or the social sciences. And one sees interesting patterns emerging, such as, for example, that small study effects is, again, on average, quite visibly stronger, moving towards what are arguably softer areas of science. And at the same time, within each of these, you still have much variance that, again, can be explained potentially partitioning more or by other factors that are probably ultimately down to the characteristic of the field. Field I would interpret as being represented by a meta-analysis itself. And so this is one first conceptual challenge that I would submit to the claim that we all make, and I make it as well, that science is facing a reproducibility crisis, that we shouldn't forget that science is not all the same, and that there is empirical evidence to suggest that these issues that we discussed are not quite ubiquitous. And connected to this, there's a second conceptual challenge that, for example, we discuss a little bit in the study that I just mentioned, which has to do with the fact that these biases are not necessarily what we normally think when we talk about these biases as being fundamentally the problem of research practices and mistakes or intentional, so to speak, mistakes made by researchers themselves. For example, because thinking about small study effects, there are perfectly justifiable reasons from a scientific perspective by which one would want to design a small study that maximizes the chances to find an effect and maybe find a strong effect. The most sort of basic scenario would be one in which a researcher has an intuition or has made some personal sort of anecdotal observation and becomes convinced that there's something to be observed in a particular condition. And so quite naturally will design a study in a very careful way to see if at least in those conditions the effect is going to be observed. And of course, in that situation, you would want to minimize the costs of trying out that effect. And so this simply raises the possibility that even though this clearly creates a bias in the literature, the problem is not in what researchers are doing, but it's, for example, in what meta-analysts are ignoring in terms of the context in which that research was produced. And it's the same mistake that as readers we might do or journalists might make when reporting on these studies and so on. A little more controversially, there might also be arguments by which not all results, even negative results, may need to be published. A quite obvious case, I would say, would be one in which the study is objectively flawed. Now, of course, the argument here would be that the researcher might not be in the best position to judge whether the study was actually flawed. They might have biases, which is true. At the same time, you know, it's hard to say whether someone else would be in a better position to judge that than the researcher himself or herself. But more importantly, I would argue that even when there is no question about the quality of a result, and even a negative result, there might actually be conditions where we wouldn't necessarily want all negative results to be published. And I know this is anathema to a lot of people, and it used to be anathema to me as well, until I started thinking about these matters in mathematical terms, essentially, and trying to think quantitatively about knowledge. And this is work in progress that I've been conducting for a while, so at the moment I'm going to refer to an essay presented in a preprint server, which, by the way, is soon going to be updated for the third time, and in a major way, so I'm soon going to release a longer version which includes more examples as well as new results and important sort of rethinking and amendments of previous analysis. Nonetheless, the central idea remains, and that is that essentially whatever we claim to be knowledge and whatever we want to discuss when we discuss knowledge, including scientific knowledge, can be quantified in the essence by this simple equation here. And so it's a function k, k purely for knowledge, in which we're quantifying the amount of uncertainty or information, as might be quantified by Shannon's entropy, but not necessarily, about something we want to explain using an external input of information plus a methodology. And methodology can be anything from the pure and simple description of a model up to the entire description of a methodology of a study, of a field, or a scientific theory. It's the same process is constantly at work. And before you start to check your Facebook accounts out of boredom, I'll quickly run to what the key point here it is, which is that this is a very simple way to think in, I think, more accurate ways about knowledge, and to analyze certain processes that, for example, interest the scientific endeavor, such as calculating the value in terms of knowledge, in terms of information, that a perfect negative result, which would be a falsification of a hypothesis, is actually able to give us. And simple calculations would show that this is going to be proportional to this quantity here, where this omega symbol here quantifies the number of possible hypotheses that are left out. And by hypothesis, you can mean also, you know, possible explanations, possible independent variables you want to test, possible methods, confounding factors, and so on. So the more you're facing a universe of possibility from which, with a falsification, you're subtracting one, the less effectively that negative result is informative. And very quickly, as this number grows, this value rapidly and asymptotically reaches zero. And so in terms of this second challenge that I was presenting, this at least suggests in principle that there might be conditions, meaning particular fields, or particular contexts within a field, or particular historical levels of development, for example, of a field, in which the costs of publishing, say, all negative results, as we often say we want, are higher than the costs of tolerating a certain amount of publication bias. The costs of publishing lots of negative results can be many, and many boil down to the fact that we would be increasing noise in the literature and the difficulty of retrieving information we can more immediately use. And so, essentially, I would submit that possibly the costs and benefits intrinsic in, for example, publishing negative results can be field-specific. Now, a third conceptual challenge still comes from thinking in terms of meta-analysis, because to some extent, the very existence of meta-analysis does show that replication in some form, maybe not an ideal form, but does occur in science. And an immediate counter-argument to that would be that, well, meta-analysis is precisely what showed us that actually many times, you know, promising results don't pan out and so are irreproducible. And this is sometimes called the decline effect. And I'm happy here, for example, to cite one of Jones' famous and highly inspiring, to me as well, results, where he showed that in genetic epidemiology, in studies assessing specific gene-disease relationships, one could frequently observe how the first studies to report a finding would report an extreme effect. And then as subsequent studies are added to an overall summary, an overall meta-analysis of available evidence, results actually decline effectively, usually approaching, in these cases, a complete null conclusion. So this is a true effect, and we do observe it as well on average across meta-analysis to some extent. But again, you see the pattern here, it's the same, and it's the same for all the biases we measured, really. So it's the same situation. You have a few extreme results, and you have a slight skew of the distribution on the negative side, as would be predicted by a decline effect. But again, there are plenty of counterexamples. Now, if one breaks this down a little and looks for simply a difference between first, you know, initially published studies and everything else, then the effect comes out as even more striking. And even though it is still indicating that on average there's about an 8% overestimation of initial results, which again, depending on the field, might be very serious or not. And the thing is that, in any case, it would be one thing if we had observed the decline effect to occur everywhere, showing that, you know, the vast majority of results actually can't be trusted. But this is, again, not really what we observe. We observe that it does occur in certain conditions and not others. And whereas some of these conditions might worry us and warrant interventions, there is also an argument to be made that the decline effect shows science working, science at work. If there was never any doubt about an initial claim, then we wouldn't need replications to begin with. And so we would want failed replications and the decline effect to be observed at least sometimes. Now, I think reproducibility studies have been a game changer in the field, and I truly believe that are going to stand out as the will go down in the history of science as being the moment where the scientific community raised its level of consciousness to by at least one step. And because of the incredible insights they allowed us to make within the scientific process. But what I'll simply submit here is that, like all truly groundbreaking research, they by now seem to raise more questions than they actually answer. Questions such as, how actually do we go about measuring reproducibility? This has been an increasing debate among statisticians, which are trying to produce ever more refined methods, but there's still clearly a lot of debate. And even deeper debates are raised about what are we supposed to measure in the first place. For example, it's not always clear, and again, this is likely to vary between areas of science, as to what exactly we are supposed to be reproducing when we conduct a reproducibility study. And so, you know, this might be a little over the top as a summary, but I think it does capture one, you know, in a sense, the main results of conducting a reproducibility study to assess the presence of a scientific crisis. And the final challenge I wanted to submit pertains to work that we did again with John and with Stephen Goodman, which we'll be talking this afternoon, and I hope I'm not going to anticipate too much of what he's going to tell us, and he was the main leader certainly on this paper, but has to do with what we mean when we say reproducibility. And we try to simplify and clarify a little the picture by indicating at least three different possible meanings. There is an inferential reproducibility, and a perfect example of this is what we just mentioned surrounding the results of the reproducibility initiative in psychology. And this has to do usually with disagreements over theoretical or methodological issues. And the solution here is primarily to foster the scholarly process as it is supposed to occur. What most people understand in terms of reproducibility is a reproducibility of results. And here again, a good example of when things might go wrong here is the decline effect. And this, the problem is, can be due to a number of different factors. There might be methodological flaws with one or the other study. It might be down to poor reporting or selective reporting or questionable research practices and worse. But it also clearly could have something to do with the intrinsic complexity, for example, of the phenomena being observed. And whereas it can certainly be improved and sustained by better reporting, more transparency, and everything that we want to discuss in this session, at the same time, can never be expected to be 100%. And again, the amount of reproducibility we should expect, it's probably likely to need to be determined by field or by context. And finally, you have methods reproducibility, and this is reproducibility arguably in the original and literal sense. And this, one way or the other, in my understanding, ultimately has to do with missing information, which could be because of poor reporting of methods or selective reporting of results and methods, or lack of expertise in who's doing the initial study or the replication study. And this is clearly what can be and should be improved by better reporting, more transparency, and so on. And this, at least ideally, could be imagined as reaching a 100%. Now, very briefly, why do I think raising these conceptual issues is important? Because if anything that I said is even partially true, then, you know, the 90% readers of Nature that in this survey declared to think that there has to be at least a slight reproducibility crisis in science are wrong. And it is therefore all the more unfortunate that a message that science is broken trickles down inevitably to the media. And these are times in which people in the media make money by shocking the public, often to the point where an obvious irony is completely missing here, that we are relying on scientific studies to prove that science is wrong. I mean, there is a logical fallacy that is somewhat lost in the chaos. And so, okay, I'm late, so I'm not going to summarize the four conceptual challenges, but I'll just mention that I think a fifth one is that a grandiose conference such as this is living evidence that science is actually a healthy enterprise. And so Lex is about to attack me, so I'll very briefly just mention what my baseline was going to be, which is that we cannot say that science is broken. I think it's empirically unsustainable, and it might have been justified in old times, and it might have served our purposes very well, but we now have evidence that allow, I think, the field ultimately to mature. And I don't think that such a narrative is actually necessary. If we really want to keep talking about a crisis, there's a sense of the word in which we should be meaning and intending that we are facing new opportunities and new challenges. And this is truly what I think is going on. Computers and the internet are taking over our lives and are making science more powerful than it ever was. We can tackle more subtle phenomena, more complex phenomena. We can do ever more refined analysis, and we are truly becoming a global research collaboration. And so these are both opportunities, but raise new challenges in a number of ways that we could discuss in terms of research integrity, and also raise the hopes of the old dream of truly having a reproducible, at least in a method sense, shared, communal, organically skeptical science. And we don't need to talk about a crisis, really, to embrace this promising future. Thank you very much.
Cases where the investor just declares poor quality and then really fights the publication. I think this is a very good concept.
I can see where you're coming from. I think that argument is even more defensible than the latter one. And again, there are costs in publishing anything, and we should be mindful of that as well. And I think in general, in the whole agenda that we are discussing, at the moment we are very focused on what to do and interventions and solutions. We are less mindful at the moment, but I think things will change, about the costs that any such intervention entails. And we need eventually, we will have to need to balance those out. So this is true of any interventions we ever make in anything in our lives, and it remains true for science as well.
Thank you again.